Chapter 56. The early morning mists hung poised over the blue water of the river, just as it had nearly 1,000 years ago when the Vikings arrived. Visibility was less than 100 yards, and the fleet of small sailing yachts and powerboats that usually crowded the river on most summer Sundays had yet to leave their docks. The mist was like the touch of a young woman, soft and gentle, as it curled around the little boat that cruised along the shore beneath the rocky palisades. She was not a graceful craft, nor did her bow and stern rise into the mist with intricately carved dragons like those that had come so many centuries before. She was a 26-foot Numa workboat, efficient, functional, and designed for a close-to-shore survey. The speed was kept to a meticulous 4 knots as it dragged the long, narrow yellow sensor below the water in its wake. Signals from the sensor were sent into the recording unit of the side-scan sonar, and Giordino stood and stared intently at the colored 3-dimensional display that revealed the bottom of the river and the submerged rock at the base of the palisades. There was no beach, only a brief bit of sand and rock that quickly dropped off again once it reached the water. Kelly stood at the helm, steering cautiously and keeping her sapphire blue eyes darting between the shoreline to her left and the waters ahead, respectful and wary of any underwater rocks that might carve up the bottom of the boat. The small craft seemed to be barely crawling through the water. The throttle of the big Yamaha, 250-horsepower outboard motor on the stern, was barely set a notch above idle. She wore only basic makeup, and her honey maple hair was braided down her back, the mist building on the woven strands, droplets glistening like pearls. Her brief shorts were white, accented by a sea-foam green sleeveless sweater worn under a lightweight jersey cotton jacket. Her feet, nicely shaped, were inserted into open sandals whose color matched her sweater. The long sculptured legs were spread with feet firmly planted on the deck to compensate for any roll caused by the wake of a passing boat, unseen in the mist. As focused as he was on the sonar recording, Giordino could not resist an occasional quick glance at Kelly's firmly encased stern. Pitt did not have the opportunity. He was comfortably laid back in a lawn chair plopped on the bow of the survey boat. Not one to put up a front to impress anyone, he often carried his favorite lawn chair and a thick, soft pad on expeditions such as this one, when he saw no reason to stand for hours at a stretch. He reached down and raised a cup with a flared base for stability and sipped at the black coffee inside. Then he resumed peering at the palisades through wide-angle binoculars, whose lenses were ground for detailed close viewing. Except for sections where the ridges of volcanic rock rose in sheer vertical formation, the steep slopes were covered with brush and small trees. Part of the Newark Basin rift system that had become inactive during the Jurassic Age, the palisades contained characteristic sedimentary sandstones and mudrocks, which had a reddish-brown color and were used to build the brownstone homes and townhouses of New York City. The steeper escarpments were composed of igneous rock that was highly resistant to erosion, giving it a great natural beauty. "Another 200 yards before we pass beneath Dad's farm," announced Kelly. "Any readings, Al?" Pitt asked through the windshield that was propped open. "Rocks and silt," Giordino answered briefly. "Silt and rocks. Keep an eye out for any indication of a rock slide." "You think the entrance to the cavern might have been sealed by nature?" "I'm guessing it was by man. If Cameron took his sub inside the cliffs, there must have been an underwater cavity." Pitt talked without lowering the glasses. "The question is whether it still exists." "You'd think sport divers would have stumbled onto it by now," said Kelly. "It could only happen by chance. There are no wrecks to dive on near here, and there are better spots in the river to spear fish." 100 yards, warned Kelly. Pitt aimed the glasses at the top of the cliff 350 feet above and saw the roofs of Egan's house and study rising over the edge. He leaned forward in anticipation and carefully studied the face of the palisade. "I see signs of a fall," he said, pointing at the scattered mass of rock that had slid and tumbled down the side of the steep cliff. Giordino took a swift glance out his side window to see what Pitt was pointing toward, and then quickly refocused on the images on the recording paper. "Nothing yet," he reported. "Steer another 20 feet from shore," Pitt ordered Kelly. "That will give the sonar a better angle to read the slope underwater." Kelly looked at the instrument dial on the fathometer. "The bottom drops off steeply before sloping toward the middle of the river." "Nothing yet," Giordino said quietly. "The rock appears all crammed together." "I have something," said Pitt, almost casually. Giordino looked up.
"Like what?"
"I have what looks like man-made markings in the rock." Kelly looked up the cliff.
"Like inscriptions?"
"No," replied Pitt. "More like marks from chisels." "No cave or tunnel from the sonar," Giordino droned. Pitt came around the side of the cabin and jumped down on the work deck. "Let's pull in the sensor and anchor the boat just offshore."
"You think we should go dive before finding a target?" asked Giordino.
Pitt leaned back and stared up the steep palisade. "We're directly below Dr. Egan's study. If there's a hidden cavern, it has to be around here. We'll have an easier time sighting it beneath the surface by eye." Kelly expertly turned the boat in a tight circle and shut down the throttle as Pitt pulled in the sensor and dropped the anchor. Then she moved it slowly in reverse in the direction of the river current until the flukes dug into the bottom. Then she switched off the ignition and shook the droplets of moisture from her long, braided mane.
"Is this where you wish to park?" she inquired with a cute smile.
"Perfect," Pitt complimented her.
"May I come too? I got my certification in the Bahamas."
"Let us go first. If we find something, I'll surface and wave you in." It was summer, and the Hudson River water was a brisk 72 degrees. Pitt opted for a neoprene quarter-inch wetsuit with pads on the knees and elbows. A weight belt with light weights to counteract the buoyancy of the wetsuit was clamped around his waist. He pulled on a pair of gloves, his fins, and hood before slicking the inside lens of his mask and pulling the straps over his head, setting the mask atop his head with the snorkel dangling. Because he would be diving in no more than 10 feet, he did not wear a buoyancy compensator, preferring more freedom and ease of mobility for moving in and around the rocks. "We'll free dive first and check out the landscape before we use the tanks." Giordino nodded silently and lowered the stepladder over the stern. Instead of falling backward over the side, he dropped down 3 rungs of the ladder, then stepped off into the water. Pitt swung his legs over the bulwark and slipped in with the barest hint of a splash. The water was as transparent as glass for 30 feet before it faded into a gloom turned green with clouds of minuscule algae. It was also cold to the flesh. Pitt was warm-blooded and preferred his water temperature to be in the low 80s. If God had meant for humans to be fish, he thought, he'd have given us a body temperature of 60 degrees instead of 98.6. Pitt hyperventilated and curled forward, lifting his legs and using their weight to push him downward in an effortless dive. The great jagged rocks were massed together like pieces of an ill-fitting jigsaw puzzle. Many weighed several tons, while others were no larger than a child's radio flyer wagon. He made sure the flukes of the anchor were securely dug into the sandy bottom before surfacing for air. The current pulled at Pitt and Giordino, and they used their hands as anchors, clutching the rocks and pulling their bodies over the moss-coated surfaces. Thankful they had had the foresight to wear gloves to protect their fingertips from the sharp edges. They soon realized they were not in the right area, because this part of the slope disappeared toward the center of the river too gradually. They surfaced for air and decided to split the search. Pitt would head up and Giordino would follow the rocky shore downriver. Pitt gazed at the sky to get his bearings on the buildings sitting near the crest. He could just make out the top of the chimney of the house. He swam against the current, parallel to Egan's house and study 400 feet above. The mist was clearing and the sun was beginning to sparkle the water, casting dappled and shimmering light across the slime-coated rocks. Pitt saw few fish larger than his little finger. They darted around him, curiously, without the slightest show of fear, somehow knowing that this weird, lumbering creature was far too slow to catch them. He wiggled a finger at them, but they spiraled around as if it were a maypole. He continued lazily kicking his fins while floating on the surface and breathing slowly through his snorkel as he watched the craggy bottom pass beneath. Then suddenly, he swam over an open stretch, free of the rocks. The bottom was now smooth and flat, with a channel cut through the rubble. He judged it dropped off 30 feet before he swam across to the other side, where the jumbled rocks appeared again. Returning across the gap, he measured the width at roughly 40 feet. The channel beckoned toward the shore where the rock slide had fallen into the water. He sucked a cubic foot of air into his lungs before holding his breath and diving down to look for an opening through the jagged fall of rock. The boulders, one overcropping the other, looked cold and somber, as if there was something diabolic about them, almost as though they held a secret they were reluctant to reveal. Weeds swayed in the current like the long fingers of a ballet dancer. He found a ledge free of growth that had strange, chiseled markings in the hard surface. His heart leaped two beats when he recognized one as the crude carving of a dog. His lungs felt squeezed, and he surfaced for another breath of air. Then he dived again, swimming and sometimes using his hands to pull himself round the rocks. He watched as a 10-inch smallmouth bass swam from under a large overhanging slab of stone. It saw Pitt's shadow and quickly disappeared. He angled down and chased after it under the ledge. A dark tunnel appeared through the rocks and beckoned him. The skin on the nape of his neck tingled. Another breath on the surface and he entered the opening cautiously. Once inside and free of the glare outside, he could see that the burrow flared out 10 feet ahead. That was as far as he decided to go. Expelling the last of his air, he returned to the surface. Al had climbed back on the boat, having found nothing of interest. Kelly was sitting on top of the cabin, her feet on the deck of the bow, staring in Pitt's direction. He waved both arms and yelled, "I found a way inside!" Kelly and Giordino needed no further urging. In less than 3 minutes, they were stroking against the current beside him. Pitt did not remove the mouthpiece of his snorkel for further conversation. Excitedly, he motioned for them to follow him. They paused to fill their lungs, and then Giordino and Kelly trailed behind Pitt's fins through the jumbled mass of stone debris. They swam through the narrow section of the tunnel, their fins brushing against the sides and disturbing the growth into a green, diaphanous cloud. Finally, just when Kelly was beginning to fear that she only had a few seconds left before opening her mouth and taking in a mouthful of water, the cavity fanned out, and she gripped Pitt's left ankle, using his momentum to propel her to the surface. Their heads came free of the water in unison. They spit out the mouthpieces of their snorkels, raised the dive masks over their heads, and found themselves in an immense cavern whose roof towered 200 feet above their heads. They stared in complete surprise, without fully comprehending what they had discovered. Pitt gazed up in wonder at the head of a serpent with bared fangs that was staring down at him.